Good morning and welcome to Shattering Myths. I am Yada. Each weekday here on GCN, we strive to expose the destructive myths associated with religion and politics, patriotism and the media, and with military and economic schemes. Instead of merely presenting the news, our mission is to understand what is actually occurring, all while predicting how the events we are reporting will shape our world. Then typically during our second hour, although this is Friday, so we will do it during our first hour, we engage God on His terms, not through faith, not through religion, but instead through evidence and reason. Since His is the lone, reliable voice in an exceedingly troubled world. Our phone number for those of you who would like to participate in this discussion is 877-300-7645. I want to conclude the presentation on what Yahweh warned us about relative to Shaul. Shaul is the actual name of the individual known to Christians as Paul. It is probably the most important, it's certainly the most condemning prophecy in the whole of the Torah prophets and Psalms. It is a prophecy that completely destroys the Christian Bible. It destroys the Christian religion. It undermines the faith, destroying it, essentially, of the largest religious movement in human history. So you'd have to say that's astonishingly important. And since we got near the end but didn't read the last comment, I'm going to begin at the beginning. We're going to read through it, and then I'm going to share some comments that were made by a scholar relative to this passage and the Qumran community at the end. God begins, upon my requirements, upon my responsibilities and my obligations, I have decided I will literally and continually stand. Well, when religious types contemplate God's Torah, they think of the Torah as being a set of laws that have to be obeyed, yet cannot be obeyed. You know, that's the dichotomy. Christians think that the God of that created the Torah was restrictive, mean-spirited, dogmatic, authoritarian, and he created a set of arcane laws of that cannot be obeyed, and yet must be obeyed, or the person dies. So that God created a lose-lose scenario, a no-win scenario. That's what Paul says, that's what Christians believe. And yet, while there are requirements to engage in a covenant relationship, there are requirements for every meaningful relationship. The Torah is rather a set of instructions and guidance, and the vast majority of requirements, of responsibilities and obligations that are delineated in the Torah are Yahweh's, not ours. That's the most amazing thing of all, is that the vast preponderance of what is described in the Torah that could be categorized a responsibility, an obligation, or a requirement is imposed on Yahweh, where He says, I'm going to do this. I'm going to resolve the issue of your mortality with Passover. I'm going to resolve the issue of your sin with unleavened bread. I'm going to lead you away from religious and political oppression. I'm going to get down on my knees to lift you up. And I'm promising that if you embrace the terms and conditions of the covenant, I'm going to empower you, make you immortal, perfect you, adopt you into my family, and enrich you. I'm going to give you everything that I have. This opening statement reveals a profound truth with Mishmereth. Al Mishmereth. Upon my requirements, my responsibilities and obligations, I have decided I will literally and continually stand, Ahmad. I will always be present, actually standing, thereby genuinely enables others to consistently stand. It is a profound truth something that I share just as a passing soundbite. That Yahweh not only talked the talk, he walked the walk. He not only told us what was in our interest, he not only guided us to the ideal result, he got down to this earth, diminished an aspect of himself, to walk along with us. He made the sacrifice to enable us for our benefit. He continues to say, I will choose to always stand and present myself upon that which protects and fortifies. There was an article yesterday out of the Vatican where the new pope, who is just an absolute loose cannon, undermined 1,500 years church dogma. When he says, you don't have to be a member of the Catholic Church. Anybody can be saved. Not anybody can be saved. Everybody is saved. The graces apply to everybody. If you're an atheist, if you're agnostic, if you don't know God, you don't want to know God, everybody is saved. Salvation applies to everyone. You know what God is saying here? You know, I've taken my stand and I've presented myself upon that which protects and fortifies. Didn't say he was meandering all over the place. He didn't say there's no reason to take a stand because, you know, I can just make everybody immortal. He said, no, I took a stand on my responsibilities, particularly on that which protects and fortifies. Then the Catholic apologist trying to make all this work kept on talking about, it has to do with he's talking about the benefits of Christ's sacrifice. This is all about Christ's sacrifice. Beyond the fact that he wasn't Greek and therefore he didn't have a Greek title, that we should not be transliterating, and they're using it as if it were a name and not a title. There's never a definite article, you know, like the Messiah, as opposed to just Christ. It's not the Christ. They're using it as if it's his name. I mean, it's just major screwed up. But what is God saying here? I will choose to always stand and present myself. When you talk about this mythical religious creation known as Jesus Christ, you're missing who took the stand. Yahweh. You're distracted. So I will be on the lookout, Yahweh says, in order to see what he will say about me. Then, how can I be expected to change my attitude, my thinking, or my response, or my disapproving rebuke, my disapproval? God concludes his comments in Habakkuk 2:1. That was Paul's primary thesis. That God's original plan was no longer in vogue. It's this idea that God, which he just said, I'm going to stand on my responsibilities. I'm going to stand on my requirements forever. Paul says, no, that's not true. God has chosen me to complete his work, and I am the lone person authorized to tell you the great secret that has been kept from the world, that all of that is rubbish, it is untrue, that it never had the ability to protect or fortify, and I'm here to tell you that God changed his mind. Maybe it's me, maybe it's my superior intellect. I changed God's mind, and now the new plan is all you got to do is believe. Who are you going to believe? You got to believe me. Is what Paul is saying. And so God is saying, why is it that anyone in their right mind would think that I'm going to change my mind? I created the daggone universe. I created life. I authored this Torah. I myself engaged to enable its promises. And yet you're going to have billions of people who are so moronic, so idiotic, so irrational, so ignorant, that they're going to believe this man who said that I changed my mind, I changed my plan, I changed everything? What's wrong with you? Then Yahweh answered, approaching me. And he said, write this revelation. And then expound and reiterate it using those letters. Upon writing tablets, so that by reciting this he might run. He, third person, masculine, singular, talking about an individual, one person, and all of human history, one man. Read this, recite it, so that he might flee and go away. Pay attention, God says. Behold, he will be puffed up with false pride. His soul is not right. It's not straightforward. He uses circuitous reasoning. He wanders away by twisting and convoluting the teaching. Nothing, he says, is on the level. So instead of him, through trust and reliance, by emunah, by being firmly established, confirmed, and upheld by that which is dependable and steadfast, always truthful and reliable, those who are upright and vindicated shall live. God has just told you that he's taking his stand on his requirements, on his responsibilities. He says he's never going to change. So where would you find that which would invoke trust? Where would you find that which would be reliable upon which he said he was going to do, since he said he was never going to change it? And yet this is the passage that Paul took out of context and twisted to say that God had decided to change everything and completely annul his Torah, which, inconsistent with this statement, Paul says, has never, can never save anyone. Still, indeed, this revelation from God is for the appointed meeting time. We've got one individual. The one individual who actually misappropriated this statement. And this prophecy regarding him is for the appointed meeting time. The appointed meeting time was in 33 CE, when Yahusha and the set-apart spirit fulfilled Pesach, Matzah, Bukkudim, and Shavuah. And guess who was in town? Right in Jerusalem. As that was happening, Shaul will return to Shattering Mists in a moment. Very Mists, I'm your host, Yada. We're considering the most important prophecy, I think, in the whole of the Torah prophets and Psalms. It is found in Habakkuk. Chabak is the Hebrew name. It means embrace this. God said, after telling us that this individual would not be straightforward, that he would use circuitous reasoning, that he would convolute God's teaching, he said, you know, instead of believing him through trust and reliance, those who are upright and vindicated shall live, based upon what can be known, what can be understood, what God has said that he isn't going to change. Indeed, this revelation from God is for the appointed meeting time. It provides a witness to and speaks in the end. Now, it's really two interesting thoughts there. One is that God has already said there's one individual that I'm speaking about here. Single, masculine, male individual. That this individual is going to be arrogant. This individual is going to use circuitous reasoning. This individual is going to be wrong. This individual is going to focus on telling people that I've changed, that my existing plan, my requirements, my responsibilities, that they don't matter anymore. This person is going to take what I have said and convolute it, and he's going to appear at the appointed meeting time, which is what Yahusha did in year 4000, Yah 33 CE, with the fulfillment of the first four Moed Mikre. There's only one person already that fits this. Only one. In the whole of human history, there's only one person now that this can possibly be about. The person Christians call Paul. The man who was born as Shaul. What's interesting here, it says, this prophecy that God is speaking about, while the revelation is for the appointed meeting time, which means it's about what happened in Jerusalem in 33 CE. And the fulfillment of Pesach, Matzah, Bukurim, and Shavuot. It says it's going to speak. It's going to provide its witness in the end. Well, 33 CE, year 4000 Yah, wasn't the end. The end is now. It's doing exactly what God said right now. It's providing its witness. The extended period of time required for this question to be resolved shall not prove it false, because God issued this prophecy 600 years before its fulfillment. Expect him, third person, masculine, singular, in this regard, because indeed he, third person, masculine, singular, will absolutely come, neither being delayed nor lingering. Now, he was right there. 33 CE, in Jerusalem. And he was immediately pounced on the scene with his false conversion and his letters and his corrupt witness. Moreover, because of the intoxicating spirit of the man, Gerber, the human being, this individual, a deceptive infidelity and treacherous betrayal. He's a high-minded moral failure. He is arrogant, meritless, promoting his own presumptions. He's doing it by justifying them through trickery and deceit. So he will not find rest nor live. He will not succeed or abide. Whoever is open to, whoever is receptive to the broad path, the opportunistic, duplicitous, and improper way associated with and according to Shaul. The individual has been named. It is the Christian Paul. Those who are open to his broad path, his opportunistic and improper way, will not live. They will find no peace. They will not rest. Mr. Pope, you were wrong. He and his soul are like the plague of death. If you believe Paul, you're going to die. Shaul, he, third person, masculine, singular, Shaul, he and his soul are like the plague of death. And so those who are brought together by him, receiving him, they will never be satisfied. They will never find fulfillment of his promises. You ought to think about that. We'll be back in a moment. Come back to Shattering Mist. After God told us that Shaul is the plague of death, and that no one who responds, is receptive to him, will find satisfaction. None who respond to him will find any fulfillment of his promises. God tells us who will be the most receptive to him, whose will be hurt the most by him. And so here is a prophecy through a Yehudim, through an Israelite, in a book that the Christian church now says, oh, that's that Jewish part of the Bible. And yet he's speaking to Gentiles. Most every Gentile, kol ha-goyim, will gather together unto him. Most all of the Gentiles, kol ha-goyim, the people from different races and nations. The people that Paul claimed for himself, the basis of his church. The basis of the participants, I should say, in Paul's faith, the Gentiles. He declared war against Yehudim, against Israel. And so God has now even identified the audience that would be victimized by the men, by this man. Then he's speaking of the Gentiles, the victims of Pauline doctrine. The Christians, he says, they don't ask questions, any of them, about him. Of course, that is interesting because Shaul means question him. That's what Paul's name means. And yet they do not ask questions, any of them, about him. I don't think I have found yet a devout Christian who is even willing to entertain the possibility that Paul was a false prophet. I won't even entertain the evidence. They don't ask questions, any of them, about him. Terse references to the word they lift up as taunts to ridicule, along with elusive sayings with derisive words. Every letter I ever receive from a Christian condemning me and what I say on behalf of Yahweh is always this way. Snippets, terse references, similitudes, cliches, adages, along with elusive sayings and derisive words, mocking interpretations wrapped in enigmas that are arrogantly spoken. Even the statements that they'll make. You know, you'll talk to someone about Yahweh saying that his Torah is forever. And the person, when you say that to them, they'll just say, grace, grace, grace. Doesn't matter. I'm saved by grace, 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 grace. Just arrogance. Stupid. Mocking God, choosing the gratia, the cute little nude girls, the lascivious party animals, over the creator God of the universe. And doing so, mocking the very God who gave them this wonderful offer. They don't ask questions, any of them, about him. Terse references to the word they lift up as taunts to ridicule, along with elusive sayings and derisive words. There are hard and perplexing questions which need to be asked of him. And they should say, woe to the one who claims to be great and increases his offspring, neither of which apply to him. God is saying, he is not great. I didn't appoint him to anything. He's not an apostle. He's not my witness. It's all a lie. And this notion that he writes about his descendants and his children, as if he was the founder of a new covenant, it's a lie. It does not apply to him. For how long will they make pledges based upon his claims of significance? Why not quickly and for a short period of time rise up and take a stand? That's what we're doing. Hopefully, you'll join me. And those of you who are bitten and making payments to him, wake up from your stupor, Yahweh says. Move away from him. Be dreadful of him. Abhor him. Speaking of Paul, he's speaking of the founder of the Christian religion. Abhor him. Stop making payments to him. And Paul is the one, throughout his letters, begging for money. Stop it. Wake up from your stupor. Stop writing those checks to the Christian church. Because you will be considered plunder, victimized by them. And that's what they think. When I asked the most famous preacher in America, and we were close friends back in the day, when I asked him why he continued to lie about God's name, about things like the Shabbat, about Christmas and Easter, about Sunday worship, about so many things, why do you continue to lie? And he says, because if I told the people the truth, the checks which fund this church and this university would stop coming in. In other words, he lied to plunder his victims. And this was the most famous preacher in the world at the time. Because you have plundered, stealing the possessions of so many Gentiles, They shall loot and victimize all of the remaining nations, all of the remaining Gentiles, because Paul looted them, robbing them of the most valuable possessions in the world, the Torah and their souls, in addition to their money. That these same Gentiles shall loot and victimize all of the remaining nations. And how shall they do it? Through the blood of humankind. They've been vicious. And also through the violent and cruel destructive forces terrorizing the land and Yah's city and all of those living in her. Christianity and its anti-Semitism. Woe to the one who is cut off, the one who is coveting. And Paul in Romans 7 speaks of how his covetousness is uncontrollable, while wickedly soliciting ill-gotten gain in relation to him setting up his house and his temple in association with the heights of heaven. Paul presents himself as the co-author of Scripture, as God's equal. He even speaks as we, just like Muhammad did in the Quran, including himself, speaking for his God. So as to spare the acquired property and possessions from the paws of his fellow countrymen. Saying that, oh, what I'm doing is noble, what I'm doing is valuable, and therefore, because I hold the keys to the kingdom of, and the keys to your salvation, and I'm the only one that can bring this to you, what you have to give me is mine alone. You have no right to it. You have deliberately decided upon and conspired at the advice of another to promote a shameful plot to confuse. We ought not give any excuses to Paul. He did this deliberately. He knew that he was being inspired by Satan. He knew he was working with Satan. He admitted that he was guided and controlled by Satan. His plot, his scheme was deliberate. It was conspired. It was shameful. It was designed to confuse. And it was in league with Satan. You have deliberately decided upon and conspired at the advice of another to promote a shameful plot to confuse those who approach your house, ruining and reducing by cutting off many of the Gentiles, the people from different races and places, and in the process, losing your soul. Woe to the one who provides and causes, allows his neighbors, his companions, or his countrymen to drink, thereby associating them with the venomous wrath, the poison, the adversary's toxin, but also making them drunk for the purpose of observing their genitals. Paul's fixation on the male genitalia is what he's referencing here. You will get your fill of shame and infamy instead of honor and glory. Inebriated, in addition, you also show yourself unacceptable, going around about the lack of circumcision. Paul's primary argument against the Torah was circumcision. God is doing everything he can to say, I've named him by name. I've told you when he's going to appear. I've told you what his agenda is going to be. I've told you who he's in league with. I've told you who he's going to victimize. I've told you how he was going to do it. And I've brought out every aspect of his persona and his style and his strategy so that you would know for certain that I'm talking about the founder of the Christian religion, Shaul, who chose the name Paulos. Circumcision is just another one of those nails right into the heart of this demonic beast. Upon you is the binding cup of Yahweh's right hand, judgment. Therefore, public humiliation and indignity will be your status, your reputation. Yosha spoke of that when he spoke of the one who would try to annul the Torah as being lowly and insignificant, as being worthless, which is Paulos in Latin. So in Galatians 3:11, Paul took part of this out of context, twisted it, to say, but because with regard to the Torah, absolutely no one is vindicated or justified, no one is saved by God, becomes evident because those who are vindicated, justified, and righteous out of faith will live. The antithesis of what God said. Then in Romans 1:7 he writes, for in it the righteous of God is revealed from belief to belief, from faith to faith. No trust, no reliance, simply faith. As it has been written by the righteous, but the righteous shall live by belief. Romans 1:17. I received a letter from an individual who cited some testimony that had been provided in a book regarding this passage about the second half of Habakkuk 2:4, called 2:4b. This is what that letter reads, and there's a couple of aspects of this that are worth considering here today. The quote is from a book called The Dead Sea Scrolls Today. It was written by James Vanderkam. And it reads, and another instance of a text cited in the Qumran literature and in the New Testament is Habakkuk 2:4b. Along with Genesis 15:6, it was a proof text by which Paul turned as he proclaimed that faith was the way to become right with God. We'll consider that in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Mist. This excerpt is an interesting story. It just kind of puts a frame on this whole thing. This fellow who is a scholar, which means he knows many things and understands nothing, writes as follows in his book called The Dead Sea Scrolls Today. He says, another instance of a text cited in the Qumran literature. So this is the Essenes, the Qumran, writing about something that is presented in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. It's, you know, the rabbinical nature is always to make up arguments based upon what is in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, or to just comment on it. That is their nature. So this is the Qumran community, very religious Judaism. Community, therefore, absolutely married to their extraneous documents, their oral traditions, making a comment on Habakkuk 2:4b. But, of course, it's also the proof text that Shaul used, and it's interesting, of course, that that this scholar doesn't mention the fact that Habakkuk 2:4, all of Habakkuk 2, is a prophecy exposing and condemning Paul. Now, if he understood, that's what he would have introduced this thing as. But he's a scholar. He knows. He does not understand. So Vanderkam writes that it was a proof text which Paul turned as he proclaimed that faith was the way to become right with God, not performing deeds of the law. Now, the reality is, that's not what God said. It doesn't serve as a proof text. There is no law. The Torah means teaching. And it's not performing deeds of the law. It's acting upon the Torah, acting upon the guidance. If you don't respond and act upon the guidance, it won't do you any good. And this is how he quotes Paul. Now it is evident that no one is justified before God by the law. For the one who is righteous will live by faith. Galatians 3:11. Also see Romans 1:17. Paul understood the word faith to mean trustful reliances on the promises God gave to Abraham. No, he didn't. Absolutely untrue. And the fact of the matter is, if this scholar understood, he would know that Abraham received the blessings, the benefits of the covenant, because he agreed to and responded to the terms and conditions of the covenant. Abraham didn't have any faith. It's one thing to say that Abraham was somehow vindicated because he had faith in, or he trusted the promises of God, but that would be completely beside what the Torah says of this relationship. It's not God's promises that Abraham relied upon. It was Abraham responding to God's guidance, his instructions. The requirements of the covenant is what caused him to receive the benefits of the covenant. He didn't receive the benefits of the covenant because he believed in the benefits. I mean, this is how convoluted the mind of a scholar can be. That's like saying that Abraham participated in the covenant because he really liked the idea of becoming immortal. No. He participated in the covenant because when God said, walk away from Babylon, he did. When God said, walk to me and become perfect, he did. When God said, trust and rely upon me, he did. When God said, I want you to be circumcised, he did. When God said, I want you to pay attention to the terms and conditions of this covenant, he did. He responded to what God was offering. Paul understood the word faith to mean trustful reliances on the promises of God to Abraham. An absolute rubbish, a complete distortion of the truth, Mr. Vanderkam. A way of life that he contrasts sharply with legal righteousness. No, he doesn't contrast it with legal righteousness because he says it is impossible for the Torah to make righteous, Mr. Vanderkam. Where's your head, pal? Why do you write such rubbish? The Qumran Habachek community takes up the same passage and offers what appears to be a rather different understanding of the faith or faithlessness means in the prophetic text. After citing the book's verse, the commentator writes, interpreted, this concerns all of those who observe the Torah and the house of Yehuda, whom God will deliver from the house of judgment because of their suffering and their faith, and the teacher of righteousness. More on that in a moment.